I need to go get a password to Google so I can get a file so I can share it because it's part of my Dharma talk. So, how about, yes, just hold on.
Happy New Year, everybody.
Yes, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, everybody.
Good to see your face.
This is where we descend into complete chaos, right?
Yes.
And start having a party.
The one on top.
Frying paper airplanes. I will jump off soon, though, because if it's a bigger group, it starts breaking up for me, so.
Try Face ID again.
Do the folks in Nizendo know that the cart computer is not muted?
It's also no microphone. It should have audio off.
Is it? Yeah, so it's not belong to audio. Okay. All right. Let me get logged into my, what is the password? Okay, hold on.
It's a really fun password. You won't forget.
I rely on a password manager for all of this, and so I don't actually know any of my passwords. No, okay. 11. Next. two-step verification. Oh. Yes, please allow. Okay. I think we can get it now. True. Okay. Share documents, class and talk notes. Okay, great. All right, I will share that when it is time. Okay. Let's see. All right. Hello, everyone. Happy New Year. As usual, I will go around and greet everyone who is on Zoom. And then in the room, each person will say their own name and will repeat it. So I will start with Bob. Betty?
Eddie.
Brian?
Brain.
Pat?
Pat.
Shoketsu?
Shoketsu.
Susan?
Susan.
Christina? Mark? Paulette? Mary? Amelia? Henry? Linda R? Jeannie, Etzido, Tyler, Vin, Sabrina, Tulika, and Ruth Ann, and in the Zendo, Jim, Linda,
Dave,
Katie,
and
Ted. Endomio. We got a big group in the Zendo here today, a whole six of us. So anyone, I've had a couple people write me and say, who are local, and say, you know, should I come? Do you need to know I'm coming? At this point, you don't need to register because we've been about 4 to 6 people on Sundays and maybe 9 people on Tuesdays. So until we approach the 16 capacity, just figure you can come and we'll deal with that happy problem should it arise. Let's see. In terms of announcements, we do have a 1-day retreat coming up in January. So that will be something you can participate in person or online, part-time or full-time. And I forget the exact date. I should have it written down, but it will be in the newsletter and it's on the Zen Center website. There will be a term student program, I believe, starting in February. So those kinds of things that you're wondering if they're coming up, you know, go to the Zen Center calendar and, you know, page through and see what's coming up in terms of 1-day retreats and whatever. And I will be working on, and I'm not sure when it can happen, but some kind of in-person retreat that at the very least it'll happen here at Bitway like it did last year. But ideally we will go somewhere and rent a place and, you know, that, but I need to look around for places that have space and, you know, and then when you're looking for spaces, you look in a very different way now in the COVID era, right? It's like, okay, well, if things are really bad, where are we going to sit outside or where are we going to eat outside or how, you know, how can we space out and all of these things. But I feel like we're learning ways to do this kind of thing safely. So, you know, fingers crossed that we can have an actual, you know, in-person retreat, which of course I'm assuming will also be accessible online. Anything else I should? Nehan, the commemoration of the Buddha's passing will be beginning of February.
Okay.
Any other questions or things I should mention? All right. So, if you are curious, also in terms of coming in person and the fact that, you know, kind of for the talk or the class, it's only feasible for me to take my mask off. I do have my hands on a pretty decent store of rapid tests, and I will be giving myself a rapid COVID test on Sunday mornings and then on Tuesdays before I come, because that's what they're good for, is to basically say whether or not you are contagious at the time. Like the next day, you might not be good, but at that time, you're pretty good. So I'll be doing that before I come. All right. It being the new year, I figured I would give a talk. I'm calling it at this point, Dread, Hope, and the Middle Way in a New Year. So, you know, the year, where the year begins and ends, is a completely empty concept, right? It's a completely arbitrary designation. But culturally, it's a time that we usually take to reflect on the state of our lives, on the future, what might this next year look like? What might we want to change in order to keep our lives on the course that we would like them to be on? And over the break, I encountered this cartoon about, and I'm going to pass it around the Zendo here and then share it online. So. Okay, I need to pull this up. All right, can people see that online? And for the sake of Ruth Ann, so this is, it's the baby 2022 year coming in, you know, the fat cherubic little baby who's supposed to be coming in. And then the last year going out, of course, is an old man with the, you know, staff. And, you know, so he's got a sash saying 2021, the old man is there. But as he meets 2022, 2022 is already stooped over with like a long white beard and a staff. He looks, you know, prematurely aged. And so 2021 says to 2022, you talked to 2020, didn't you? And I felt like it was such a summary of just, 2021, I guess, was better than 2020, I guess. But like, whoa, you know, it's not exactly like a joyous, what will the new year bring? There's a lot of potential dread going on. Even if your personal life is going well, which it may or may not be, right? Sometimes we end up in times where we have financial or health or whatever kinds of stresses and things that we're worried about, that even if your personal life is going well, there are many things to dread in the new year. The worsening climate crisis and the fact that our governments seem incapable of responding anywhere near fast enough, 2022 elections, the degradation of democracy, ongoing uncertainty about the pandemic, which just doesn't seem to end. So every one of us, no matter how you are conscious of feeling, every one of us has an attitude toward the future. And whether we're conscious of it or not, we can't help, but we have to have some kind of attitude toward the future, even if we're just kind of ignoring it. And this ranges from dread that manifests in our lives as anxiety or depression, pessimism, despair, cynicism, anger, and manifesting possibly in ways that really affect our everyday lives, preoccupying our thoughts, affecting our decisions and relationships. Sometimes this can even become debilitating, interfering with sleep and health and enjoyment of our lives. Or maybe we experience some of these feelings, anger and despair, whatever, when we allow ourselves to think about the future. But most of the time, we just kind of avoid thinking about it. But dread still just lingers out there in the background, a subtle source of stress, a gloomy backdrop against which, you know, the close perspective, maybe our lives are going fine, but then you kind of look out and, Or maybe your outlook is positive. We'll figure things out. It'll all be okay. It's not as bad as we think. People have always thought the world was going to hell in a handbasket. And I'm not here to dismantle your positive worldview if you have one. But Zen is about facing the truth. So it's important to examine for yourself, and I'm not saying this is so, but it's important to examine for yourself whether some part of your positive outlook is denial. Not that I would blame anyone for using denial to avoid despair. So I wanted to explore today what attitude should we take toward the future as Zen practitioners. In early December, I gave a talk I called Practicing When Your Country is Broken. And in that talk, I talked about how Buddhism doesn't promise a rosy future of peace on earth. It doesn't, or even in heaven. That's not what it's about. On the other hand, it actually says, what do you expect? Somebody promise you something great? Like, why do you expect something more? So in that talk, I talked about freeing ourselves from dependency on our narrative, acceptance of conditions, meaning accepting that here we are, not passivity about what comes from here on out, but just, all right, here we are. I talked about bearing witness or facing the truth, how to do that in our practice, and how to take care of ourselves and stay strong, how to take action and engage the world with generosity. But what attitude toward the future is authentic, healthy, and helpful? What attitude helps us face the truth, but also stay strong and take appropriate action? So I wanted to focus on the middle way as a way to frame our practice in this regard. So the middle way was one of the Buddha's first dharmic discoveries, if you will, and one of his first teachings. I mean, it was his first teaching, according to the scriptures anyway. And it means refusing to be caught in extremes. But it is also not just a watered down compromise, like halfway between. So the story of this in the Buddha's life was he had lived a life of indulgence as a, you know, rich prince type person. And he became dissatisfied with that lifestyle, recognizing it wasn't relieving his suffering, it wasn't answering his spiritual questions, it wasn't the way. So then he went over to the other extreme of asceticism, of, you know, starving himself and, you know, sitting really hard and trying to crush his mind with his own mind and all of these things, hardcore asceticism. And he realized that wasn't it either. So his discovery was the middle way when he remembered a natural kind of meditation that he spontaneously entered as a child, which is described very much like our Zazen. And he thought, maybe I should try that. But he needed to, you know, walk the middle way in terms of asceticism in that as well, and take some nourishment, take care of himself, but not go over into indulgence. So that was his first experience of the value of the middle way. And that was indeed his very first teaching. And he described to his disciples that the middle way was the Eightfold Path. So there was, on the one hand, indulgence, on the one hand, asceticism, and in the middle was the path of practice. So you might call the middle way the third way, or the other option. The other option, the other possibility you're likely to overlook as long as you're caught in duality. So as we think about the middle way, and we're about our attitude toward the future, we should call to mind the middle way when we feel stuck between two bad options. So perhaps on the one hand, there's dread, contemplating all the bad things that can happen or are likely to happen. We read and watch the news, inform ourselves, and it can seem like the number of awful things down the road might vastly outnumber the positive, or the forces of good can seem like a small, just like a candle in the wind of a supercharged climate change storm, right? So we can kind of dwell in that dread, or in the case of our personal lives, you know, contemplating, anticipating the bad things, and, you know, what might unfold, and how might we respond, and how might they feel. And maybe the other extreme is denial, ignoring what's going on, or another perhaps form of denial can be a certain kind of hope, clinging to a narrative about how everything will be okay no matter what. And by okay, what do we mean? Because I think there's something sincere sometimes when people, you know, they say, I'm not that upset, everything will be okay. Well, what do we mean by that? So in the December talk, I addressed this a little bit. There's we can have a deep and profound sense that everything will be okay. But this is different from a hope, a belief that certain things are likely to happen or not happen. So, you know, hope might be a belief that technological inventions are going to, you know, prevent the worst of climate change. They'll figure it out. Or a sense that, yeah, you know, somehow our democracy is going to heal itself and it'll all work out. Or, you know, in a personal case, you might just, maybe somebody close to you is really sick and you're just, I know they're going to get better. And it's fine to have hope if you have it. You know, it can be completely sincere. But that kind of hope is dependent on conditions, dependent on certain things. You know, you have that hope as long as. So in some cases, hope can be the opposite of dread. It's a state you need to maintain. It's conditional and fragile. And in the back of my mind, anyway, when I am sustained, and again, it's not necessarily a bad thing, but when I'm relying on that kind of hope, then I think of people in the world and the many, many thousands, countless of people in the world right now in circumstances where it'd be pretty much, I mean, to find that kind of hope would be extremely difficult. People in countries where war and corruption, repression, poverty are unending, political prisoners. We hear about when they're locked away, but then we forget about them. And there they are living out their lives. I mean, if we were in that kind of circumstances, it'd be very difficult to manufacture that kind of hope that everything is going to work out. And I know this isn't pleasant to contemplate. And my intention is not at all to deepen your dread or anxiety or depression or despair. However, if we face the truth mindfully in the context of our practice, also taking care of ourselves in order to stay strong, we build tolerance and strength. We become less and less likely when we don't have to live in denial. This allows us to live more liberated and fruitful and intimate lives. And then we can explore this middle way. What is the other option? And there was really like, I realized there were kind of two dualities that I was thinking of here. So there's kind of the dread versus hope, like, oh, all these terrible things are happening, or, you know, it's all going to work out. So it's, that's, you know, those two kind of different views. But then also in terms of our relationship to what's going on in our lives or in the world, I kind of thought of maybe it'd be good to say kind of obsession versus denial, kind of being obsessed with like informing yourself with about all the suffering in the world, which is pretty much infinite. So you could, if you're going to go down that road and try to completely inform yourself, there's no end to that, right? So that could be the obsession part, but then the denial part being like, you know, nothing I can do, I don't want to worry about it. So what are the other options? So as the Buddha said in his first teaching, the middle way is our path of practice. So it's not one attitude. It's not a fixed view. It's living deliberately in order to minimize suffering, maximize happiness, peace, wisdom, compassion. So I thought our practice attitude might be best described by our physical attitude or posture in Zazen. You know, unmoving and centered, like I'm right here, I'm not running away. I'm not running towards. I'll deal with what comes when it comes. Not anticipating or avoiding. Making a conscious choice to be present for whatever happens. And we sit upright, whether we're on the floor or in a chair or on a bench, we're sitting upright, which is an attitude kind of confidence and straightforwardness. And confidence in, not in our small self, but confidence in, I don't know, I like to describe it as the life force we're part of. Things will arise. Some of them will be painful. Some of them will be wonderful. Responses will arise within us. Things will pass away. In that deeper sense, everything will be okay. And also in Zazen, we let go of the effort to anticipate and control, which are both a manifestation of our small self. We grow comfort with our true self, which is a lively, boundless manifestation of life, meeting each moment as best we can. And of course, as I talked about in the previous talk, letting go of the narratives. As we contemplate the future, we might become aware, it helps just to become aware or to frame things in this sense of like the extremes of dread and hope, obsession versus denial. You know, what is going on? What is going on in my experience, in my mind, in my heart? Is this an extreme? Mindfulness of when we get caught in either extreme. And then asking ourselves, you know, what is the middle way? Because sometimes we're clinging to one of those extremes because we're like, but I, you know, I don't want to fall into the other extreme. So, well, you know, what are the, it feels like there's no other option. So practice invites us to like, you know, is there no other option? Explore it. What is it to live fully in this situation without getting caught? So we have to turn the light within and explore our own experience. And remember that the middle way is not a fixed place. So I think it's often better described as just not getting stuck, not falling into duality, being real. Just so in a way, like how should I respond is just like, well, just, you know, kind of don't worry about how you should respond. Try to just be with what is in a more immediate way. When we're facing the truth, facing something, we can refrain from distancing ourselves from that truth by creating a narrative, either a positive one or a negative one. We call this don't know mind. Recognizing that sometimes we have to make a guess, you know, a judgment. I don't know, how are things going to go? What kind of decision do I have to make based on how I think things are going to go? Right, but that is still just a guess. So we have to recognize that our narratives about how things are likely to turn out are just that. We don't know. And I think all of us recognize that even if things do more or less turn out the way we expect, they're still not really the way we expect. There's more to them than that. There's other aspects to the full situation once we get there. And don't know mind is not, it's not at all denial or passivity or refusal to engage. It's, you know, okay, here's the facts as apparent, you know, are apparent to me right now, but included in that truth is I have a limited set of facts. I have a limited point of view. I can't know the future. So that's all included. practically speaking, as we contemplate the future, as we bear witness and face the truth, we balance this with taking care and taking and staying strong. And only you know how that balance should manifest in your life. And it's a balance that needs to be maintained. That's why I like to call these like the taking care and taking action and bearing witness as ingredients. Because you're like you're cooking your life. You have to cook it fresh every day. And, you know, we're always balancing these things and conditions change. So your practice needs to change. So some questions, some things to explore. As you think about the future, how much time and energy do you spend obsessing over the future, personal life or in the world? Reading the news, the predictions, imagining what might happen. And can you recognize this as obsessing and invite yourself to balance this with Zen practice, Zazen, time with Sangha, mindfulness, Dharma study, spaciousness, exercise, sleep, you know, all of that. Taking a break from the news or mindfully balancing, you know, regular media, which is whatever political stripe basically designed to sell now. So it's like clickbaity, whatever end of the political spectrum it's on, sensational. You don't get, you know, that kind of thing from the positive stories. But there are some news sources out there that try to emphasize the more positive. There are books that we can read and documentaries and things like that that remind us that that's the negative isn't the only thing going on. Or if perhaps your approach is to avoid thinking about the future or, you know, reaching too far out in the world for additional information on suffering and misery, because it's just stressful and depressing and you don't know what to do about it. Are you keeping yourself informed as a citizen? Our country is going to need all the hope it can get over the next few years to make sure we guard our democracy and keep it going. Are you living your bodhisattva aspiration when it comes to the beings suffering in the world or to our children's future? Are you sticking your head in the sand because you don't know what else to do? And if so, then can you recognize this as, once again, just being caught in an extreme? And ask, what other option is there? The other option we often think is to like, then I have to become obsessed and I have to live with this sense of overwhelm and dread. You know, let's explore if that's possible, necessarily so. And of course, Buddhism says there is another way. Can you experiment with exposing yourself to the truth a little bit at a time and taking that attitude of Zazen toward it? Letting the truth be, letting your responses arise and pass, recognizing your innate strength, and recognizing how you don't need to have all the answers. There's a, you know, there's still a value to facing the truth, even if there's nothing that's obvious that you can do about it at the moment. Can you explore the miracle of how it actually feels better to allow things to flow through your experience instead of bracing yourself against them? Or if you find yourself clinging to a kind of shallow narrative of hope, pushing away the details and the warnings in favor of a vague confidence that the forces of good will win out no matter what. Can you question this or recognize this as also possibly being caught in an extreme? And this is a questioning you do within yourself. And it requires courage. It's not a question you inflict on others. It's not a question I'm inflicting on you, as if I hear you say something positively, like, oh, stuck in an extreme, you know? I don't, if it's sincere, this is something we do within ourselves. So hope can be real, but is our hope sometimes a subtle form of denial? Is it keeping us from facing the truth and responding appropriately? Can you relax your grip on your positive narrative a little bit in favor of resting in that don't know mind for a while? And it doesn't mean embracing a negative narrative. It just means opening up, which usually leads to more intimacy with life. Sometimes more pain, but also more of the good stuff. So there's no denying that we're living in stressful and frightening times. Are they more stressful or frightening than any previous age? Who knows? But I do believe humankind is facing an existential crisis for the first time. And this has a profound effect on all of us, whether we're conscious of it or not. We either get our act together or we face a very scary future. We can't even just count, like, there's been awful, awful times in human history. We can't even at this point just count on nature continuing on her, you know, kind of larger, implacable rhythms. We can't even count on that. There's like nothing we can count on. We could end up, overall, this could end up being a positive thing, you know, a human existential crisis. Maybe we rise to the challenge. Maybe true transformation happens. You know, maybe we witness a lot of this in our lifetime. This could be an opportunity. We don't know what's going to happen. And we will be happiest personally and best equipped if we walk and live the middle way, refusing to get stuck in extremes, neither living with dread nor clinging to a conditional kind of shallow hope, neither living in denial nor obsessing, facing the truth, staying strong, taking action. Here we are. So leave it there for comments and questions. If you want to, if you're online and you want to say something, you might click the reactions button. Or unmute yourself. Ruthann, did you have something?
Yes, I wanted to share that last Wednesday before the Dharma talk at Y East in a little chat room, we were a couple of us laughing about, remember where we were a year ago, saying good riddance to 2020. And we thought, okay, we're not going down that dead end anymore. Because like Bill Moyer said, hope that doesn't take action becomes toxic. This morning on a radio show, Pathways, I heard a physicist wrote a book called Bright Future Now. He said 80% of our daily lives can be using new systems that work. We can't count on present systems. And he said that has to be harmony first, internal growth, relationships, social, and then our harmony with nature. But I decided my 2022 word is focus on being neutral for myself, not to go into the trap of good and bad, and just to turn to my practice with more zeal or confidence or comfort. Thank you for this talk.
Thank you, Ruthann. That's great. Let's see, Dave in the Zendo here, and speak up if you can.
So while during your talk, and you were juxtaposing despair on one hand and hope on the other hand, I couldn't help reflect that I almost feel like hope is the middle way, because, you know, I've been in states of despair, but in order to get out of that, I had faith on the other side, counteracting that. And I feel like, you know, I don't do this practice because I know for sure that it works. I do this practice because I've chosen to believe that it does. And for me, at least, despair tempered by faith becomes kind of hope in the middle, you know.
I think we are agreeing and just using terms differently, because they do, you know, they do say that the three essential components of practice, another way to frame all of this, right, besides the middle way, is great doubt, great faith, and great determination. So in a way, that I feel that doubt is that openness, right? Like we don't know really what's going to happen, and you know, and questioning ourselves, are we falling into extremes, etc. We have that's this aliveness, when instead we're just slipping into some kind of fixed view. But the faith is, it's not in some particular outcome, right? It's in this process. Like if I just keep practicing, you know, that things will be as good as they could be, which is huge, which is, yeah. So that, relying on that, like I was saying, there's nothing, it feels like there's nothing in the world on which we can rely, but we can rely on our practice. Good point. For anyone who's new, we just sit here for a minute in silence, and usually something like the Quakers, see if anything arises.
I'm Shuketsu. Tell me, you often say, and I know you've said it in past talks, that we balance taking care, taking action, and what's the third one?
Bearing witness, or facing the truth. Yeah.
Okay. That's my question. Thank you.
Oh, that was easy.
Yeah.
Betty.
Hi, thank you for the talk, and Happy New Year, everybody. I'd like to think that I could carry doubt and sort of constructive optimism together, that they're not, there's not a duality between those two thoughts. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think, I often feel like one of the main things that we're doing in Buddhism is building up our tolerance for ambiguity. So this is something that like a term in psychology. They can do tests, and sometimes people see things just black or white, yes or no, good or bad. And you know, some of us come with a little bit more of an ability to understand and tolerate ambiguity, like exactly like you're talking about, Betty, that, you know, somehow at the same time, I can have this, you know, have some sincere optimism, and I can go, I have no idea, and hold those at the same time. And it's like, because this is the reality, life is that way. Life has different levels, and there's apparent contradictions, but somehow it's not really a contradiction within. So in through practice, I think we build up our ability to do that. Mm-hmm. And I feel like a big example of that is the fact that we're trying to cultivate an understanding of emptiness and no self. And at the same time, it's presumed that at the same, you know, especially when we see that, suddenly this deep vow emerges to save all sentient beings. Like what? But I feel like we can have that at the same time as we can realize everything is okay and nothing is lacking. We roll up our sleeves and say, what can I do? Because every single being matters.
Yeah, thank you. I had I was sending people happy New Year greetings. And I found myself not wanting to say, have a great 2022. So I took great out and I put tolerable. Have a tolerable 2022. That's great. How sad.
Yeah, that's kind of the mood right now, but I'm glad we can laugh at it. You know, thank goodness. Brian.
So I sometimes feel that the Dharma talk is gives me a homework assignment for the week, and so I should report on that. And so the one that I think I'm taking away from today is in your phrase, intimacy with life as a goal of practice. And I think that's, you know, kind of worth reflecting on, and I will. It certainly embraces the idea of bearing witness and taking action and taking care of self. And it was also occurring to me, it connects to the idea of emptiness as a way of clearing away all of the clutter that stands between you and that more intimate relationship with life. So I probably won't let you know how I do with it, but that is what I intend to reflect on over.
Yeah, I'd love to hear back. Yeah, I think so much of our practice is in a very encouraging way being adapted by modern psychology and applied to people with great effect. Just so, you know, apart from existential stuff, just dealing with suffering in your own life and learning not to, you know, brace against it or obsess about it but just to kind of be with it and let it move through and ground yourself and trust it's going to be okay. And, you know, because sometimes we just, the things that are looming out there seem so scary that like, I don't want to go there. But for one thing, they're like, the only thing we can do at this point is be with our feelings about it. Because if it's not here, we can't really be like, you know, allow that thing to move through if it hasn't happened yet. But we can be with our fear and our longing and all of that. And it feels better. afterwards. You can move on through as opposed to being locked up inside. And yeah, we may experience great sadness and tears and grief and fear, but then it tends to move on through, be transformed into something else. Ted.
One of the things that I've been struggling with is you talked about, like, you know, the, you know, climate change and the existential crisis that we're dealing with and, you know, suffering. Is I have lately felt like, I feel like I want Buddhism to offer me like something beyond this life. Like I've been feeling like I want, like, why aren't I being offered an afterlife? You know, something, you know, okay, I deal with whatever suffering that I deal with and other people, you know, in the world deal with, but I should be offered something afterward. And yet Buddhism doesn't necessarily offer that.
And actually I talked about this recently. It was a Dharma Q&A because somebody asked that, you know, like, what, you know, what is the Buddhist view? And
yeah.
And I realized like that. So what is, you know, at a deeper question is what are we looking for in that solace? You know, that solace, that sense that, you know, whatever happens this go round, you know, at least there will be some ease, there will be some peace, there will be some resolution, there, you know, reward, whatever. And I feel like our practice does offer that, but but not in the form of the afterlife, right? Good question. I guess what our practice invites us to do is really explore reality deeply. And it tells us, if you do explore reality deeply, essentially, maybe you could say, you don't need an afterlife. If you wake up to what really is, it's not scary and painful and all of that the way that it is now. So it's this invitation to reality isn't as bad as we think. I guess even despite what happens in our lives. And I guess it's to go most directly at it, like just for myself, I never believed. So I never even enjoyed that solace. It was just like, life is just like meaningless and bleak and ugh, you know? Now I guess it's like, it just looks like that when we are in the elusive dream of small self. You know, it's like we're in this bad dream and it's all self-centered. And when, you know, even just for a moment, we can kind of break out of that dream. And then we realize, like, for one thing, our self nature is boundless. So there's something that is going to end when I die. But I live in and through everything around me. So when my physical body dies, you know, I don't die in a way. And only that kind of separateness is resolved. And there's a a way of realizing that boundlessness of self means everything is self. So that there's that sense of intimacy with, you know, the carpet and the flower and the sound of traffic and everything. So I guess, you know, one of the analogies that I've heard is the sense of, you know, being a wave and you're actually just part of the ocean. And temporarily, there is this sense of like, look at me. But you've never actually been separate from the ocean. And nothing is lost when you go back to the ocean. So I guess it's like a shift of the way that we experience life, which yes. means.
And I definitely can be there and have that sense of yeah. what you're saying for sure, especially when I, you know, heard your previous teachings. But then there's part of, like you said, the small self that goes, you know, okay, if I'm going to deal with all this, I deserve something afterward, and it should be guaranteed. And,
right.
You know, there should be something in Buddhism that says that we get to do that, but that has to happen.
Yeah. So hard to let go of.
Yeah.
Especially when we've countered other, you know, spiritual traditions which have that.
Yeah.
We're like, eh. All right. We've got a couple minutes left. Any last burning questions?
I don't have a burning question, but about that little way, and I was trying to think if there was ways that I was doing that. And over Thanksgiving, my family had the usual, you know, my son had said, come over for Thanksgiving, but you have to be vaccinated. And then one of my nephew wasn't vaccinated. And so there was this, you know, the kerfuffle. That, you know, it's painful. And I just kept thinking, is there a middle way? Is there a middle way? I mean, I wasn't like saying middle way, but I was trying to find that it seemed like it was just like these two sides of this intractable issue. And one of the things that was helpful was my nephew and my son talked, you know, just talked. They didn't change their minds or anything, but they talk. And I finally decided that I needed to change some behaviors that I had done. I was leaving him out because in a way, kind of like denial, like sort of pretending that I didn't have to deal with him when I was inviting people over for family things. And so finally I just sat down and wrote him a letter and said, you're always gonna be my nephew. And I'm going to tell you about everything that's going on. And when it is appropriate, you'll be able to come, you know? And I just kind of left it at that and I'm going to do that. I'm going to tell him when things are happening. And, you know, I just feel like that's the right way to treat family with respect. I don't know. So that thing that it was, that I was doing that was not in a way, was sort of pretending he didn't exist in a way by not including him, you know? So anyway, that was.
Thank you. Did yeah. people on Zoom hear Katie? Cool, excellent. Yeah, I think that's, just that one question. Just when there seems like there's two bad options and we're stuck, when we feel stuck, just that one question is like, is there just another way? Some, without getting stuck in either of those things, is there some other way to respond? And oftentimes just that amount of reflection can help something open up. All right, I will say our closing verse. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water. The mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time. All honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas. Wisdom beyond wisdom. Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you for being here, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Be well, everybody. Bye-bye.